Welcome to the Sports Pro Podcast with Sports Pro editor Owen Connolly, getting inside the sports industry and recording it on audio.
Hi everyone, and welcome to another Sports Pro Podcast. Delighted to have with me the Global VP for Sport and Entertainment at Mediacom, Misha Sher. Hi Misha.
Good afternoon.
And the head of Football Fan Network, Copper 90, James Kirkham. How are you doing, James?
Very well, thank you very much.
Well, two newcomers to the pod today, but there's something else that's back, and that's the European football season. 25 years this year since the start of the Premier League era, which basically was a quantum leap, really, in terms of how football is watched, how it's consumed, for want of a better word, around the world. But some things apparently don't change. The BBC releasing a report commissioned for them by the Pinch of Salt agency, I think, but suggesting that 60% of Premier League fans in the UK still watch all of their Premier League football on the BBC. James, any thoughts about that?
Feels like a loaded question. I don't doubt that a lot of people do continue to watch the likes of a match of the day to consume football. It is just a diet made up solely of that, what I would call in class alt media, in no way satisfies the appetite of a modern football fan. From millennials, from people my age, and I'm ancient in comparison, let's say to someone like my son who is 8 and his consumption of football that he is obsessed with, it is just entirely different. So there might be a part of it that still is about match of the day, but I dare say the rest of it looks like what we know only too well, that people search out goals as GIFs on Twitter because it's all about speed and agility and seeing it in a moment. The word moment, in fact, is everything. People turn moments into memes and they live entirely online far longer than anyone even remembers a score. Everything about the consumption of the game is different. From this summer, my beloved Man United had their star transfer signing announced by another player on his Instagram story, which he scripted himself. No one kind of even mentions how that's orchestrated anymore, or the assumption is it's not even a United thing. It is just the way we accept it. That proximity an audience has with talent because of Snapchat and Instagram stories is entirely different. We could go on. So, yeah, I have no doubt that maybe, you know, some broadcast elements from old traditional TV, as per something like a match of the day, still exist within the broad appetite, but is in no sense the whole picture anymore.
I mean, we've talked on this programme a few weeks ago about the launch here in the UK of Sky Sports new vertical channels, their single sport channels, of which the Premier League is one. But yeah, that primary point of contact for a lot of people is still intact, but for lots of others it's not, Misha.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's as James just said, these things have evolved and evolved at a pace that I think many of us are struggling, or a lot of people, you know, in our space are struggling to come to grips with. They're trying to understand, you know, what that means to the, you know, to the model that we used to have. And, you know, last time that, you know, the Premier League rights went to market, is it going to be drastically different this time around? Just because the consumption habits have changed, and we're going to have different, you know, are we going to have different OTT, you know, platforms get involved, digital, you know, social media channels? It's all really, it's fascinating to follow. I think it's still a bit early to say that, you know, the whole model is going to be turned on its head. I think there's still, you know, in the linear TV is still going to be, you know, for time being, a predominant player. Because, as you know, that demographic isn't, you know, that shift isn't going to happen that quick, although it is happening, especially with certain, you know, with younger audiences. But, you know, I think we've seen, even with, you know, with Wimbledon, you know, even though they've taken some of the content and put it online, or put it on their digital channel, it's still, you know, the bigger audiences came still from, you know, from linear TV. So I think it's a fascinating space. I think we're going to go through probably the biggest change in this space that we've seen in probably 20-25 years in the next probably 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, the 25-year point is fascinating, isn't it? And the fact that we're recording this pod today, 25 years, I think, what's today, right? The Premier League started.
Yeah.
a quarter of a century. Now, in a quarter of a century's time, this will not look at all similar. So I don't, I'm going to get my dates right, I think. I don't think Amazon existed 25 years ago. I think it existed something like 22 years ago. I think it was in its inception. It was a book retailer, a pretty efficient one, but it was selling us books online, and they are about to go pretty big, as we know. They're already hitting sports. I'm sure you've covered it. You're looking at players like that coming into it with such muscle that it is a pretty uncompromising ability that they're going to have, and an approach to things to mix things up, because they're born from a different era. Facebook's efforts, likewise, it feels like they're just sort of scratching the surface and having a little dabble, and I think Liga MXA and the Mexican League kind of stuff, and what they're going to be playing out on Facebook Live versus what they can play within Messenger. There's too many kind of platforms that are about immediacy and kind of a currency with, as you say, a younger generation, that it just has to change things, you know, and is changing things. So the space is fascinating, and absolutely, that I think it's just what TV even is. I don't want it to get too hypothetical, but it's kind of, you know, the kind of thought is always it's TV in the corner of a room, of a lounge, four or five family members sitting around at that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, it's more kind of what it is, you know. The diet is so spread and so mixed from different devices and different places at different times, from your ability to search and have it on your kind of control, on your terms, and generally built around an environment you want to spend time with. I said a year ago, I think something like messaging environments like WeChat in the Far East could end up being the dominant players here, because people never leave them. If we donate to charity, order our pizza, order our cab in the same environment that I'm messaging my friend, then stands to reason I can also watch a game there. Maybe with a micro payment or press my thumb.
Yeah, like, that's convenient. I think over time that's probably what's going to happen, because while people crave more things, they don't actually crave more places to go get them. Right. So that habit is still there. They would love, you know, if they could get their scores, follow their players, follow the teams, see the highlights, and they could see it all in one place. There's a big benefit to that. So, you know, fans don't want to be flipping through different apps, different websites. Messaging apps and so on to do that. So I think over time, that's probably going to happen. And in places like China, where WeChat is so dominant, that could, definitely be the case.
Yeah, I mean, the Premier League revolution, of course, was one which effectively drove the mode of watching things that we've grown used to until probably 2-3 years ago, which is that you have your free content and then you have premium stuff, of which, you know, the Premier League was a part when Sky bought it all up. And of course, you talk about being able to find everything in the one place. You knew if you wanted to watch live Premier League football in the UK, that's where you would watch it. And, you know, similar things happened in other countries,
which was a real benefit, I think, at the time. I remember when Setenta, you know, came in and they tried to break up the rights, and all of a sudden I used to have all my football in one place. Now I have to buy Setenta. So now I've got to buy two channels. It costs me more. The experience is worse because Setenta spent all the money on the rights, so the production was poor. So, you know, ultimately, whilst they were trying to break up Sky's monopoly, it didn't actually do, you know, over for a fan, it wasn't a better experience.
One thing that's an interesting development over the last 18 months, I guess, is the fragmentation and possibly the decline of live audiences. Now, I mean, Copper 90, you work a lot with younger audiences. You obviously are an online platform. Mm. Is that something? Is something fundamental changing here, or is it just about the means of delivery not quite having caught up with the means of consumption yet? What do you think's going on?
Probably the latter. The on-demand nature of consumption of a young audience is kind of everything. Their convenience is all. It is entirely on their terms, and it's not like a misplaced arrogance. It's simply the world which they've grown up in. And again, it feels cliche to say it, but it's entirely true. And subsequently, it will only be on their terms. And I'm talking kind of 25 down. We're not talking, you know, even teens. So with that in mind, that can't help but kind of, I think, drive the state of life. Live's an interesting paradox as well, because there are many live, in inverted commas, bits that we would do, which rate fantastically well, and, you know, that you could have many people in front of you right now talking up. we do live kind of transfer specials, we do live behind the scenes moment, we eventize bits around certain games that we only do live, bits that you can't necessarily get elsewhere. We might leverage a platform like a Facebook Live and really bring out a visceral excitement around it. So in one sense, live's amazingly important to deliver against that. What is interesting is that whether it be Sky or whether it be ESPN, we are seeing the decline of their live, in inverted commas, audience. They're kind of the classic Super Sunday, the big iconic stuff that they advertise and get a lot of people to every single week, is simply going down. And that, for me, is about convenience. And if you've got a plethora of platforms, if a, let's not even target an age, if a young consumer wants to get his fix of Tottenham, Newcastle, it does not necessarily mean he needs to be there at 2:30 on Sky Sports to watch it. Very, very simply, it might be the consumption through the iPad, seeing that goal. Might be, let's be honest, for our illegal streams that everyone's incredibly aware of, it might be seeing it as a GIF, like I mentioned. It might be seeing, following the likes of a Bleacher Report or a Copper 90. And much of it is infused with that comment and editorial too, which they often kind of want. It's on their terms, shots of content when they want it, so it doesn't mean they need to sit there. And I do worry a little bit about that in a funny way, despite my role, because I love a 90-minute football match. It's fantastic and it's incomparable, but there is perhaps less inclination to sit through 90 minutes. I think the World Cup will show that for the first time more than ever next summer in Russia. I think we're going to see some startling statistics around how much and how many of those full games are watched. It's 11 different time zones. It's a huge country. Half of the world are asleep when the matches actually start. And yet it's a global game. The consumption of those games, I believe, will be so much around the shots in the morning, the little blurbs like on the back of a book that you can get your fix of the game. And then that's enough.
Yeah. I think it's also a reflection of how people are actually consuming sport, right? Which is mostly on mobile. No, well, not mostly, but increasingly on mobile devices. Now, mobile devices are not it's great for highlights and you know digital. Banter and so on. Like say GIFs, all that sort of social kind of wraparound experience around the match is great for that sort of medium. It's not, you know, they're not sitting in front of the television the way they used to. I think I saw a stat that in, 2010 World Cup, something like 18% of search came from around the matches came from mobile. By the time it was 2014, it was 65%, right? So you can, that is, you know, I mean, it's a huge jump. And you know, now I think one third of all consumption of sport is on mobile devices and growing. So I think that also dictates, you know, that people aren't going to watch, don't watch 90 minute games on small screens, you know, so they might be consuming it live, but it's just a different sort of, you know, different formats, different things that they're doing to consume the match rather than just to watching in its entirety.
Yeah, it's funny, I remember writing a column about this about, must have been maybe 3 or 4 years ago, maybe not as long as 4 years ago, but the decline of the traditional highlights package, but also the way of watching the traditional highlights package, which Misha, I don't know if you've absorb this cultural reference in your time here, but the whatever happened to the Lightly Lads scenario of trying to avoid the result.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Is something that's long dead. And the challenge now, I guess, for any media organisation is how do you get back control of that experience that people are having where they are watching, as you say, they're watching live, even if they're not watching the live broadcast. Yeah. Is it something that you can do? Do you just kind of have to let it go and get what you can of it?
I think anyone who's attempting to wrestle back control is fighting a losing battle. I think you can fuel the conversation and therefore help orientate the conversation towards you, depending on what you're putting out there, the quality of your content, how you're editorializing, what it is that you're adding, frankly, that is augmenting a fan experience, full stop. I think the moment it feels like I need to wrestle that control, it feels like what people in the music industry tried to do 15 years ago and failed, and we all saw it. And sport is undergoing the same level of disruption as music did. It's just it doesn't have its Napster moment. It has many, many different moments. It's like a death by a thousand cuts, but it's not dying. On the contrary, it's never been bigger and it's never been more alive. It's a fascinating kind of dispersion, if you like, of where and how you find it.
It's an interesting note to finish part one on. Join us just in a few moments. Welcome back to the Sports Pro podcast. Now, we're here in Cafe Kick in London's Exmouth Market, which would have been a place which maybe a decade ago people, well, and they still do, but a decade ago it would have been the kind of cutting edge of the football fan experience to come to a place like this and watch games from leagues across Europe and across the world. But the way that communities come together now, football communities, fan communities, is changing, and sometimes it's not even involving football. It's involving the culture of football, maybe. But it's something quite different, James.
Yeah, I mean, maybe here is an interesting kind of paradox. We're living in a world at the moment where content is disseminated in the way we've just described, where it's so fragmented, where people consume it on their terms. But part of the reason Copper 90 even exists was to maybe bring back some of that spirit, to be on the side of the fans. We thought 6 years ago that some of that had been lost, that in the increasingly commercialised, homogenised football world, there was fans were feeling disenfranchised, fans were feeling distant from players, spiralling wages, out of control agent fees. Now, those things haven't changed. Only last year, wasn't it, that fans walking out of Anfield because of rising ticket prices, but still an arrogance in some of the people who own the clubs, thinking it doesn't matter. So we were kind of very much on behalf of fans, where we turned the cameras around and said it was all about the fans, actually, and a fan-centric approach was novel then, and perhaps has since been much mimicked, and people understand it more readily, and brands certainly, I think, are embracing it wisely, because it's commercially smart to do so, but it's also right and interesting. So for us, football has an unbelievable purpose and a role to play too in life. We have it like daubed on the walls of our office. You know, for us, it's the universal language. It's the most accessible one we have. It can heal division. We put tournaments on for the refugees in Dunkirk in France. We've done football films about refugee football, about amputee football, about unknown women's teams in southern Wales. It's an unbelievable uniting force that can capture the attention and excitement of so many. And so for us, that fan positioning is absolutely key. And here again is the interesting part, because so much of what we're talking about in terms of technology and changes and the way it's consumed, that is being taken away from maybe like a Sky, but that is being driven by fans, because fans are the ones choosing to see that goal on their terms through those means on the platform of their desire. It's everyone else who's trying to kind of suddenly catch up and say, oh, it's good, we're going to embrace the fans, actually, and we'll kind of appeal to them. So I think that's a good thing. It's the might of and the power of the people involved, and I think the more people kind of acknowledge that, the better.
I mean, something that has been happening over the last couple of years, but we're now starting to see mainstream coverage of, is fan communities that are being built around things that are not mainstream football, whether that's, you know, it doesn't matter what tier of football that is, but around professional men's football clubs, basically. And some of that is, you know, burgeoning interest in the professional women's game or the semi-professional women's game, which has been furthered quite significantly by the ability to build communities digitally. But some of it is stuff that it's to do with fandom as much as it is to do with football, whether that's stuff like hashtag United and Spencer FC, where it's kind of, let's just get a bunch of guys together and watch them play football and follow their journey, whether it's FIFA, which has always been a part of, or, you know, FIFA and similar games have long been a part of fan culture. But because their home is digital, it's kind of a natural place for them to bring people together online. And obviously one of your signature shows is FIFA and Chill with, was it Vooch and Poe?
Yeah.
Where does that take the conversation for brands, Nisha?
Well, for brands, it's all good news, because all, you know, brands know one thing that they're really struggling with, right? When they're trying to do things in sport, is authenticity, right? Because it's about the main reason why you get into that environment is try to get as close as you can, you know, to people's passion points, right? And if you can do it through the eyes of the fans and the way that they accept and the way that they've set out to do, then it's a story that would really, really resonate with them. Every single client that we work with now asks that question, right? They don't want to just get into that environment in the same way that they would do other things, right? Or they invest in other marketing or communications channels. Sport is all about trying to get into that on that sort of emotional level, connecting with people. So the ability, if you can, for brands, if you can get into that environment and you can enhance that experience, it can empower fans, you can empower those communities, right? So if you can get behind Spencer, you know, Spencer FC, and if you're a brand that's all, you know, that's rooted in that community or wants to be seen as supporting what, you know, what football is all about, ultimately what it's all about at the grassroots level, then you can only benefit from that. Because that's what fans gravitate to. You know, they're becoming, social media has opened, you know, has opened things up for them, right? It's given them a voice, right? And they're looking for, for sponsors who are involved in the space to empower, to enhance that experience. I think we're seeing a lot of that now.
I think that's really wise words. And you know what? You know, as much as digital and social at times can be beaten up for many different reasons, you've got to give that an awful lot of credit. I think you alluded to that in your kind of build-up. It simply has connected nodes that were not connected previously. There is a wonderful, exciting, vibrant network of people around the world. I mean, Cobb and I have a creator network, which we call it. Not a huge amount of people know about it, but it's several hundred individuals, both in front of and behind the camera, around the world that we connect up and can talk to on any given day, who can make us stuff and we can feedback and we can use with brands, or they can do research on our behalf, and they're individuals that we pay. And they're just a microcosm of the wider community. And so if we want to go and shoot that piece tomorrow in Senegal, we can. We don't need to have an office there. Mm. Football does that. Sport, as you rightly say, does that. That is the brilliant benefit of sport. It's a passion point that connects so many. And enthusiasm is infectious. Often gets forgotten as well, I think. In the machinations of businesses and certain marketeers and certain places, you forget that this is football, for goodness sake. Like, there could not be a better... arguably, only music is comparable in something that can just be so conductive and exciting that people want to talk about. We've done series before. We've engaged creators around the world and simply gone, show us a beautiful picture of football in your local area. And you have the most incredible imagery from every possible conceivable place, from the beach in Rio to a jungle to... And that becomes our Instagram series for 3 weeks. You know, it's... At times it's easy, you know, and at times you can harness that, and I think that's a lovely thing. It's a wonderful passion that we should all cherish.
Yeah, I mean, the way you guys operate is, you know, you're able to be quite nimble, you can be quite reactive. You put together something in the UK during the general election, with the FIFA and Chill series, where you managed to get Jeremy Corbyn, who's the leader of the opposition, to appear and talk about his platform, which I think did him a lot of good. It was kind of connecting nodes that weren't connected before, as you mentioned.
That's what I said. But that's football, because it transcends culture. It cuts through. And yeah, we did a very apolitical interview for obvious reasons with Corbyn. It was not about us showing support for the Labour Party. Mm. We started off on Hackney Marshes talking about a football initiative. But yeah, the Times and the Telegraph and people kind of reported on it as citing part of the mobilisation of youth that ended up kind of influencing a fantastic result for him in an election. Now, I love that, not because it's about the support for Labour, because it's about, that's what football does. Mm. You know, being able to have this thing we were called the other day by a magazine, The Voice of a Generation, being able to have that influence only through football, that's what I love. It's a brilliant thing to embrace.
But of course, you're also a platform for brands, and I'm not talking specifically now about the political dimension, but the... having the attention of that audience, and also them feeling like they are a part of what you're doing, even if it's something as simple as your show at the moment is FIFA and Chill. Mm. If people start gravitating back towards another title, that, you know, that's what they're playing online, that's what they're playing on their PlayStation, their Xbox, whatever. How far ahead do you have to be able to see, and to be able to bring your partnerships with you in that, and you know, bring the whole thing together?
Very far ahead. Our hit show of last year was a show called Saturdays Are Lit, which was one of the biggest football shows on the planet, and it was in Snapchat for 90 seconds. We hijacked the Bleacher Report Snapchat Discovery channel, and we effectively did Soccer AM for an audience now, and it looks nothing, as you can imagine, like anything before. It's about irreverence and madness, and it's insanity for a 16-year-old on the back of a bus on his phone. It's exactly what you would imagine. It's utter craziness and nonsensical, and it was huge. Now, that was effectively brought in as a brief of what would you do if you did Soccer AM now. but then a bunch of 24-year-old and under minds came up with it. And they had to be so future-facing, so they had their own stimuli and kind of assorted sort of influences, but they were very future-facing. And that was one of the first things I've ever been involved with, where the day it went out, I think we had four phone calls from brands, all wanted to be a part of it, because it's brand new. So you have to be new. You have to be... It's your challenge you set yourself all the time. It's the challenge I set the guys back in the office all the time. It's, we have to stay ahead. Plus, you have to stay ahead because a lot of people copy you. And I'm sort of... Never mind too much, because it's quite flattering, and I know you all empathise and have seen it with the great stuff that you've done. People then mimic it. But that's kind of cool, because then you go back to the office and you go back to the troops and you go, you've got to keep staying ahead. And then people always want to flock to something that is... It's not just about being new, because that can end up in the world of gimmick. It needs to be new with impact that changes things. When people mimic it and copy it, that means you've done something right.
Let's take it back from the digital to the physical and the experience of actually going to football matches, which has obviously changed. It's been the biggest transformation in those 25 years of the Premier League, probably, is what it's like to go to a Premier League ground versus what it was like to go to a First Division ground in early 1992. Are we between the possible advent in this country of safe standing, which is something that has been in German football for a very long time, and in a few other countries has been introduced in at Celtic Park in the last year. Between that and between the kind of ever-escalating premium experiences at new grounds, are we starting to move away from the homogenous one-size-fits-all match day experience?
Yeah, we are, and rightly so, because if you look, you know, because match day experience doesn't exist in, you know, in a vacuum, right? You're trying to attract people that in every aspect of their lives are getting served more and more individual personalized type experience, right? wherever they go, whichever whether it's retailers or entertainment experiences, they're becoming a lot more, even your social media, everything's becoming much more personalized. So, and we're different people, we look for different sort of experiences. And I think I read somewhere a couple of weeks ago that that fans would increasingly prefer to stay at home, because now the way the sport's being delivered, they can watch in the comfort of comfort of a chair. They can be chatting to their peers on a second screen. Everything's set up, and the experience is nice, right? So then to get out and go and pay the high ticket prices and so on. So I think there's a lot of people still say, yeah, but there's no substitute for live experience. And I would, I'm a bit older, a bit old school. Yes, I think there is no substitute for that. But you have to look at sort of general population, and especially the younger fans, if you want to make sure the next generation is coming through, their expectations of what is an experience has evolved. You know, so what they want is not just to go somewhere and sit there for 45 minutes and then go wait for a pint for 15. Hopefully they get one, and maybe not. You know, so it's all about, hey, is there, if I'm there, is the Wi-Fi good that I can share this experience? Because increasingly people, if they're there, that's what they want to do. Majority of them want to be able to tell a story, want to share it, share it, want to talk about it, and so on. Most, a lot of the grounds still don't have that. So when you're looking at, when you're looking at the new stadiums being built and the sort of things that they have now, there's not even standing room, it's sort of like clubs. It becomes kind of a social, it becomes a day out, an experience that where the actual match is just part of what's going on, because ultimately people are looking for something more. They're looking to socialize, right? And they don't want to be sitting next to two same people the whole time. They want to be in the group, right? And it's things like that. Some of the American stadiums got pools in them. And I mean, it's all, it's a bit over the top, but I think that's it's a reflection of sort of what is a day out, what's an experience now.
Yeah, they're almost like different industries. I mean, I'm a Man United fan, so I go to Old Trafford a lot, but I live in southwest London, so I take my son to AFC Wimbledon, Hampton and Richmond. They are like different industries. They are almost incomparable sports. But I adore our trips to AFC Wimbledon and our kind of half-time chips and, yes, having a pint in what's basically a corrugated iron hut and maybe a Bovril in the winter. And it's all very quaint and sweet, and it's a little standing terrace, and it's much more what it felt like 30 years ago. I mean, going way back pre-Premier League, there was a lot of, you know, let's not beat around the bush, there was a lot of aggro, there was a lot of some nasty places to go to. It wasn't like it is now. Mm. You know, in any of the places, and he's absolutely right. You go to, you know, look at the Emirates, it looks like a spaceship, crying out loud. It's a phenomenal piece of infrastructure, but it is just created an environment that is very nice and very clean and very safe, and good bits being a lot of families are going into football. Bad bits maybe is that maybe it's over-sanitised, and maybe, you know, that is thus the importance of the lower leagues and the importance of those little grounds like Hampton and Richmond, and how vital that is in the whole spectrum of football. And but you say you have the same abroad, you know, you could be in an Italian lower league and a Spanish lower league, and we go a lot to Spain and see clubs like Formentera and San Rafael in Ibiza, and they're brilliant little grounds and cauldrons of noise, and they're tiny. And that's football. That's brilliant football. It's an entirely different football to watching a big European like Old Trafford.
Mm. Yeah, and clubs at that level have shown an aptitude for creating fan bases for themselves that go some way beyond the local communities. And you know, the idea is obviously that they are rooted in those local communities. But Dulwich Hamlet is another club south of the river here. FC St Pauli have been doing it for years, where they are, you know, they're the cool club. They exist just on different terms from others in that league. What's the future of it? Is there going to be a place for the fan who wants to experience some of that kind of the earthier aspects of football going to watch Premier League games? Can that be filtered into that?
I guess maybe evolving from what I've just spoke about, I just think there's room for both tiers, and having both tiers to your love of the game is a very natural thing. It's more natural now for people my son's age, going up to teenagers. It's more natural for them because they've got an encyclopedic knowledge of a game that's built from gaming, from FIFA and Football Manager, where my 8-year-old boy knows the third choice right back at Atletico Madrid, and he walks around in a Borussia Dortmund top, and he cares about Rapid Vienna, and I didn't. I was very tribal in the 80s and knew my Man United, knew my Barclays League Division 1 and whatever it was, and that was kind of me done, and an occasional awareness of a European tie would bring to life. Everything is altered. It's an encyclopedic knowledge and an appreciation of players and individuals and where they go, and they like watching that. But so I think that's a wider, more continental connoisseurship of the game, which is brilliant, actually. That's the thing that's fallen out of gaming, I think, that is a brilliant kind of thing to come out of it. And why not? I would love the idea that, a bit like the FC United and Manchester story, I'd love the idea that there's always the chance to, you go to your local club, you go to your lower tier, you go to a Dulwich Hamlet, whatever those places, you go, you know, the Clapton kind of story is an amazing one. You've got that. And of course you can go and watch your Liverpool if that's the team you support, and that's the, you know what I mean? I think there's hopefully a lot of room for that because they feel so different. There's no clash, in my opinion.
Agree. Yeah, I don't think you have to choose one or the other. And, you know, these days you've got the thing with football, you know, Jesus mentioned it, it's truly global. I mean, there's nothing really like it. And I think what you're finding out with a lot of these teams and through the sort of proliferation of social media is that most of the fans of these teams live nowhere near the clubs, right? So, I mean, it's great. It's a shame because a lot of people who have grown up and have supported Liverpool or some of these traditional teams, right? They look at, you know, they don't care about the fans in Thailand and so on. But actually, you know, if the fact that some of these people who live on thousands of miles away can follow a team, can feel part of that community, and increasingly, with technology and with social, they can feel as close to that experience, you know, with VR and all of that coming in. They're gonna, you know, they, it's great that someone can, you know, someone in Melbourne, you know, in the next 12 months or whatever, can put on goggles and feel like they're sitting in the cop. I mean, there's nothing, it doesn't take away from the experience that someone is having in Liverpool, but the fact that we have people crave that experience, that interest all over the world, and we now have the ability to deliver that. It's fantastic.
Is that a challenge to, particularly to the bigger clubs, that an association they've maybe taken for granted with previous generations of fans, perhaps even exploited, is something that is not going to exist in quite the same respect as it did before?
feels like they've already adapted, though, right? Their scouting networks, from players' perspective, their, you know, Man United's deal with Uber in the States, the obsession with the money that's coming out of China and the Far East, and what the world. I believe that train has kind of left the station, and they have been fully aware that it's not all going to be predicated on the little 3-mile radius of the stadium anymore, you know, and such is the infrastructure, the businesses, and they are businesses. The businesses' tentacles go very, very far around this world, and, you know, and but it comes the other way too. That's not just a Premier League thing, you know, that's look at the influence of this, of Real Madrid and Barcelona. As I say, increasingly, young people have an increasing interest in things like the Europa League, because that's more interesting to them, because they're playing teams that they've been playing, or rather watching teams they've been playing on FIFA that they are seeing for the first time. They're not watching Bayern Arsenal again for the fifth season in a row. They're going, oh, fantastic, that's FC Midtjylland, and I played them on FIFA. And
that's interesting.
And I love that. It's like a little discovery engine.
Plenty to discover this year. I'm going to be watching a lot of Europa League football for the first time myself this year as an Arsenal fan, yeah. So
it's good fun.
Yeah.
I can say as a United fan, it's an underrated competition.
I'll take your word for it, and we'll see how we go. Anyway, we'll leave it there for part two. Join us again in just a sec.
Enjoying this Sports Pro podcast? Well, we're also the sports industry leader in print, digital, and events. Head to sportspromedia.com for the latest features, news, and interviews from the business of sport. Help yourself to a subscription to our acclaimed magazine and find out about our unmissable conferences before anyone else. Get inside the industry with Sports Pro.
Part three of this new football season special of the Sports Pro podcast. Now, the biggest story of the summer as far as club football goes, it's not one that we've been able to get away from as hard as we've tried. Neymar, the superstar captain of the Brazilian national team. Is he the captain still? Anyway. Moving from Barcelona to Paris Saint-Germain for €222 million, which is a similar fee to what was reportedly paid for Southampton Football Club, or 80% of Southampton Football Club, yesterday by Lander Holdings. Misha Scher, you've worked with some big names among football players. You worked with Pele. Not sure we really need a second one.
yeah, that's definitely enough.
It seems that, you know, there's a lot at play with the Neymar transfer. Obviously, there's the golf politics and, you know, the wider soft power project that PSG's always been for Qatar. There's financial fair play and perhaps we'll get onto that in a bit, and the mechanics of that and how they'll be affected by what PSG are trying to achieve here. But the biggest thing outside of that seems to be the relative profile of someone like Neymar set against a football club, set against a whole league in France. You know, what are the dynamics at play there? Are we now starting to see the profile of star athletes exceeding the profile of the competitions they're attached to, or is, how do you view that?
Look, I think in the case we shouldn't draw any big conclusions just from that transfer alone, because very few players come, you know, there are very few players like Neymar or like Messi or Ronaldo who genuinely have the power to to go somewhere and transform just a club or league, you know, for that matter. I think, you know, you rightly mentioned the political context of this transfer. I think you can't talk about this without mentioning that, because, you know, it comes at a time when Qatar is, you know, increasingly isolated, right, you know, internationally. So this is a statement. It's a statement from them. It's a statement from from the ownership of the club in terms of where they see this PSG on the global football map, and more importantly, where they see the French league. I mean, they've made a big investment in that, you know, in PSG. They've been trying to bring big name players to the team over the years, and, you know, have done succeeded to a varying degree. But I think Neymar is a game changer. I mean, arguably, you could say in the next 2-3 years, you know, Neymar, I mean, he is already one of the top 2-3 players in the world. He's going to, you know, French league guy is going to have the best player in the world, right? He's not going to be playing for Bayern Munich. or Man United or Real Madrid or Barcelona. He's going to be playing in France. So, you know, in and yeah, it's definitely going to increase the appeal of the team, and it's going to appeal of the league and appeal of their rights and things like that. You know, are they going to make that? Are they going to be able to recoup that kind of money? Unlikely, you know, because the financial is just you know, the math doesn't work that way. Do they need to know? They need to. But for them, it's a real, you know, to be able to say that we've got, you know, we own PSG. We've got the best player in the world. He's 25. He's got best years ahead of him. Playing in our team, you know, for foreseeable future, is quite a statement.
Are we able to situate this in a wider sports and media landscape where Floyd Mayweather is fighting Conor McGregor, where we've just seen the kind of Usain Bolt show for a week in London, even though he's only won one bronze medal and is not kind of the athlete he was, where you're not looking at the competition, you're looking at the individuals. And where, I mean, you mentioned it earlier in the show, and very much, you know, the summer is about individuals because it's about the transfer market and it's about these tours and people making contact with players they've never seen before. But where Romelu Lukaku's transfer to Manchester United becomes about the relationship that he has with an existing Manchester United player, is there something going on there with where fandom has shifted to individuals?
I think huge. I'd love to get Misha's perspective, actually. I don't know. Because I'm not quite sure what I would articulate there. You've got an influence of basketball where it was prevalent that players would effectively bring in and welcome other players into teams. That's kind of a known thing the last decade or so. Pogba's a massive basketball fan, and he kind of made a sweet little joke calling himself an agent within an Instagram environment. But that's a thing now. That's kind of established. We've all watched it. It's played out in like faux comedic form on our Instagrams, and that's the way it's announced. You know, the last season's announcement was arguably my most sophisticated orchestration of a transfer, I think, ever by a brand, with Addy and Stormzy and Pogba. It was just brilliant. So something's going on there. I think what you're also getting to, which is just startling and fascinating, is the power in the athlete. The player power is huge right now in the Premier League. It's a discussion point on almost any kind of radio show and stuff like that. And this kind of sulking until they get their move. It's happening right now at Coutinho. Sanchez, arguably your man, might be leaving to City. Who the hell knows? But that power goes way beyond a fallout with the manager. They can orchestrate those moves. Their dealings are so infinite with their agents, with the machinations of the system, the ecosystem around the player, the use of brand, their involvement with other brands, involvement with other teams. A highly sophisticated model, isn't it, that kind of player thing? And only in the last kind of day or two, I think we were reading and seeing more and more about players and their own individual actual profiles. So, you know, it was only a few years ago we were marvelling at, oh, what? So this guy's got his own Twitter feed. And then it's like, oh, right, so he doesn't need the press conference. He can just put out what he wants. And that's like, well, yeah, of course. And now we can't imagine another world where you're not seeing what the guys are doing on Snapchat. That proximity is everything. You've never been closer to this talent, which is interesting as a consumer. You've never been so near to these players, and yet they're like modern-day deities. They are like immortalized like gods in games, but you can see what they're eating for breakfast. You can watch Jesse Lingard filming on a Man United bus as he got stoned by West Ham in real time. It's phenomenal. And in the old days, we were watching a press conference that was staged and boxed off and looked the way it did for the last 30 years, and we all accepted that, oh, that's kind of normal, and they came out with prosaic answers, yeah, faux media training, and it's incomparable.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And look, the reality is, I think the fans have always craved that. You know, fans have always wanted to get closer and closer to the action. Now they can, yeah, right? Now they can get as close as they can to the, you know, to the people that they idolize. So that's quite a shift. I mean, and not just to see what these people are doing and you see what they like and the personalities. I mean, but they can interact with them, right? So some of these guys will host a chat. They'll work with their partners and maybe auction off or whatever. They'll give away some, you know, a signed item. I mean, it's the ability to get as close as you can to someone who, you know, not long ago seemed so, you know, so far removed. I mean, just wouldn't. And if you think about the clubs that they play for, right? The club has to have a very sort of professional approach to everything, and that, you know, there isn't going to be much personality from Man United or from Arsenal or from Real Madrid, because it's just that, you know, because they are an institution. Whereas Neymar can through his channels to express exactly what he's all about. And in many cultures around the world, by the way, and we've known this for some time, fans are more fascinated by players. They're interested in players and not teams. They don't necessarily follow teams. So, you know, if a player, you know, if David Beckham goes from Manchester United to Real Madrid, they follow David Beckham, right? So there's that sort of, you know, there's in China, that's the case. So, and I think that's a fascinating, you know, it's a fascinating thing. That speaks to the power, you know, that players like Neymar has, who, outside of being a phenomenal footballer, he transcends his sport, right? I mean, Messi, for as great as he is, doesn't quite do that, because he doesn't have that sort of charisma that Neymar does. You know, people are hanging on every word he's saying. They want to, you know, they want to cut their hair like him. They want to wear glasses like him. They, you know, because he's a cultural icon as much as he is, you know, as a footballer. So, I think it's,
in a way, it's, you know, you can't argue with it. When I was a kid in the 80s, Brian Robson was a big deal, moving from West Brom to Man United. He became our captain. The actual scenario is it's presented to you on television during the news that you'd only watch at one point during the day, at the end of a news bulletin at 6 o'clock. You saw the manager, Ron Atkinson, shaking hands with your new player, as brought to you, orchestrated by Martin Edwards, the chairman. The entire thing was enveloped and framed via the lens of Manchester United Football Club of Business. Cut forward to this season, Romelu Lukaku says in a joke to Paul Pogba on Paul Pogba's own Instagram story that he is joining him at training tomorrow, and they mock up a sweet little funny dance around a swimming pool in LA. He couldn't be a greater contrast from 1983 or whenever I've just been referring to. But like you've just been describing Neymar, that kind of makes sense, because anything else wouldn't now, would it? It would be impossible to retain a level of control when you're talking about a 220 million.
But why would you want to? You know, why would you want to? If this is why fans are tuning in, this is the kind of stuff they want to see, the sort of things they'll talk about. It's the sort of stuff they'll share. It's exactly what the club wants. You know, they want this to be as close to the fans, as authentic, you know, as it can possibly be. I mean, how many times can you tune in and watch someone holding up a shirt, the same spot, you know, with the same people, as, you know, as James just mentioned. So I think the ability to sort of cross-pollinate that way, and not, you know, with different players and different genres. It could be last year with Stormzy, yeah, with different platforms. That's a reflection of where we are today. And I think that we're gonna be seeing a lot more of that, because that's what the audience craves. It's the kind of stuff that they're desperate to see.
We started off with a discussion about the uncertainty around the media environment and how that's gonna develop. Is this basically the surest way for teams and brands to kind of to glom onto those changes that are happening, so fast? But if you frame that through an individual and through the activities in an individual, you've got a ready-made connection then with fans and with people in a way that you don't if you're kind of trying to steer the bigger organisation through that.
I think if you had a brand, I mean, we've got two people around the table at the moment work a lot with brands all the time. If brands themselves were around the table, they would admit, perhaps confidentially, that however much money you pay Messi, there is an uncertainty about what you might get out of him and at what point. And that's an open secret within talent in sport. And do you know what? It goes way beyond that. You know, that sports and ends, that's just talent. I think if a brand realises that they're in a world now where talent is articulated in a way like we've just talked about, you know, we call it in Copper 90, it's kind of four-dimensional talent. It's literally a world away from me having a poster of Brian Robson entirely in 2D, and you can't get any further. All of the proximity conversation we just talked about, all of the fact that you can follow them on platforms like a Snapchat or see them in real time, in real life. As long as that is acknowledged, then the brand's got a great chance of success, because these are the means that we can access talent right now. Right this second, we could pull our phones out and start looking at a post from Lukaku or a Pogba or whoever it was, and see some really intimate, close-up kind of sport, football, training, whatever it might be. The brands need to clock that and realise anything less than that won't resonate.
OK. Well, it's livening up around here, so I think we'll call it a day. For that Sportsbro podcast, but thanks very much to James Kirkham.
Thank you very much, been a pleasure.
And thanks again to Misha Sher.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Next time.